It is 8:31, and we have here live in the studios this morning, Jav Parrish and Trevor Griffey filling in for Maria Tomczyk.
Yeah, Maria's not feeling well, and we've instituted the Eat the Airwave stop loss program.
Just stop Trevor from leaving.
Trevor thought he was going to leave, but he's back for another tour because, well, you know, he didn't have a choice about it. Okay. So welcome, Trevor.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, starting out with local news this week and some more announcements, electoral announcements.
People running, people not running, people fleeing in terror, et cetera. Well, first of all, Jay Inslee made it official, what was widely rumored last week. He announced formally this week that he will be seeking the Democratic nomination for governor and abandoning the 1st District Congressional seat that he now holds. That led to a couple of other things. Brian Sontag, the state auditor and more conservative Democrat who has kind of made a name for himself doing audits based on Tim Iman's I-900 performance audit initiative. He also is widely expected to jump in the race for governor. He said he will make an announcement by July 4th, which is Monday, so we have that to look forward to over our holiday weekend. Also, Roger Goodman, who had previously filed paperwork to run against Dave Reichert in the 8th District, even though he actually physically lives in now in the 1st District. But the trick with this is that those district lines are going to be changed with the redistricting that will be announced next January, and he could be in either the 1st or the 8th or a newly created 10th district. It's not really clear. Anyway, he changed and did what a lot of people had expected him to do all along, which is to jump into the 1st district race after Inslee announced for governor, kind of a game of musical chairs here. And then one other opening that's coming up is that Sam Reed, the long-term moderate Republican Secretary of State, announced that he is not going to seek a re-election in 2012. So we now have three statewide offices in 2012 that we know are going to be open seats, those being governor, which Greg Warr has announced she won't seek re-election, attorney general, because Rob McKenna will be seeking governor, and Secretary of State, because Sam Reed is retiring. Those will all be open in 2012, so it's going to be a very, very interesting year.
All right.
And a moment of silence for the Dan Evans Republicans.
Sam
Reed being the last of the liberal moderate Republicans in Washington State,
who is probably best remembered for his actions in 2004, I believe he had just been was that his first term? I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
With the Greg Warr Rossi race, where the state Republican Party was extremely anxious to prove voter fraud in King County and making all kinds of allegations, and Reed wouldn't have any part of it, a display of integrity that definitely did not endear him to his own party. So we probably won't see his likes again in the Republican Party anytime soon, based on current trends.
No, if you hear the term Dan Evans Republican referring to the president, you should correct the person who makes that assertion and basically say they're gone now.
All right. Let's move on. UW officially voting this week to raise tuition again.
Well, this is widely expected, and yet, part of the ongoing privatization we're seeing across the country as a sort of trickle-down effect of the budget cuts and the anti-tax backlash. The state of Washington has been sort of paying less and less to its institutions of higher learning for decades now, but once the economic crisis hit, it really started pulling from its public universities to backfill some of its other budget cuts because their budgets were so substantial. The higher education budget is quite large, and the immediate effects weren't going to be seen as much as they would in other programs that might be ended entirely. But the ultimate effect of that, and I believe that the state divested from institutions of higher learning, its sort of public university system, about 33% over the 2009 to 2011 biennium. In the 2012 to 2013, it was another figure about that much. So we're talking about 50% roughly of the state government's funding of these institutions dropping off over the course of 3 to 4 years. And so the institutions have been faced with this challenge. Do we eliminate whole programs to preserve the affordability of what we offer and reduce our offerings in order to keep the affordability going for a few students that remain? Or do we just pass all the costs of what we have now on to the students? And that's the direction that they've gone. And the state legislature, in a way that is very much buck passing in this regard, gave away its historic control over tuition setting authority. It used to be that the legislature would determine that, and it gave it to the universities. And so what we saw at the University of Washington with its Board of Regents vote this past week was sort of a preordained, and they have decided, they had increased tuition 15% a year the past couple of years, and now we have a 20% increase. And in addition, they're bringing in more out-of-state and out-of-country students who are paying even higher levels of tuition to help subsidize the rest. There are promises, literally called the Husky Promise, whereby the UW claims that it's going to use these higher tuition from those who can afford it to subsidize need grants for those who can't. But the devil is always in the details, and in this case, I think it's pretty unlikely that we will see many middle-income families who are already up to their eyeballs in debt be afforded the kind of support that they need. And so what we're really seeing is the costs of government services being passed on to the consumers, and those who can't afford it are in trouble. And this is the closing of the door to the middle class, and there has been, it, because education is such a key element of class mobility in this country. And the effect, essentially, is that while there is some resistance, it's been belated, and it's a tough situation all around.
Yeah, and there's been a couple of other trends that have dovetailed with this also. One has been the devaluing in our culture of liberal arts education, and the sense that, well, you go to college for job training. Again, as Trevor says, that does a couple of things. Number one, it impacts class mobility, because people who can't afford to go to college, or who go to college but go to college by incurring massive amounts of debt, are then funneled into professional jobs rather than a liberal arts education or something that might not be so directly job related, because they are so concerned about finding well-paying work immediately after graduation, work which is much, much harder to find right now, particularly during the economic downturn, for people who are newly graduated from college. Just getting an undergraduate degree is not itself a guarantor of employment at this point either. And then the second part of that is that, you know, the UW itself is one of the largest corporations in in Western Washington, and one of the largest employers in Western Washington. And the decisions that its Board of Regents makes are all about money. Anybody who has ever been to a major research university or worked in one knows this is true, that in many cases undergraduate students are kind of an afterthought. They're not where the real money is. The real money is in research contracts, and a lot of that has been much more corporate driven in recent decades. And so the actual presence of students on the campus becomes less of a priority than it might have once been. And, you know, all of this is sort of combining to what in my view has been sort of a loss of the original mission of creating land-grant universities and state institutions of higher learning, which is not simply to fund corporate research, but to create a citizenry and a middle class in particular that's well-educated. And that's kind of essential to a democracy in a lot of ways, part of the civil society that makes democracy possible. And we are losing that here in Washington State. And we're also, heaven forbid, making it a less attractive place for potential future employers. So a very worrisome development in a lot of respects. Yeah. And not one that's going to be reversed anytime soon, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and we could have a whole show on this topic, and so probably can't cover too much more, but I'd like to throw in just a couple quick points. One is that there's been almost no news coverage of any other institutions other than the UW. That the UW, because it's such a behemoth that has 40,000 plus students, 20,000 plus employees, almost 5,000 faculty, takes up so much of the reporting that we don't see the crisis as systemic. And that, in addition, there are any number of other public universities that are facing similar challenges that are also increasing tuition. And so are community colleges. Right now we have Seattle Central, killing long time or planning on trying to kill its, video editing and some of its graphic design and actually vocational training programs just because the community colleges have reached a point where they can't increase tuition too much more. Or else they don't serve their intended audience anymore. But then if they don't, then they just have to cut because there's no room left to cut. The other thing is, the vice chair of the Faculty Senate had a good quote recently. He said that the UW was...
UW you're talking about. Yeah.
The UW, was once a university that ran a hospital. And now it's a medical complex that runs a university. And that is essentially representing what Jav has talked about, which is that the UW Medical Center, while being a nonprofit, it takes in billions of profit every year and has used that to expand throughout the region. And so you have this massive medical complex that is expanding and growing at the same time that you have a shrinking support for its educational mission. But I would say they're not going to reduce enrollment. They're just going to charge more, and we're going to see a less diverse student body in a state that already is... has made affirmative action illegal.
All right. Well, that's a good segue on to our next item, court ruling in Michigan that touches on affirmative action.
Yeah, the ruling wasn't in Michigan. It was the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is similar to the Ninth Circuit out here. It's the regional court of appeals for the federal justice system for all of the Midwest. And they overturned the Michigan law that banned affirmative action. This was a Michigan state law that came out of the infamous 2003 Supreme Court ruling around the University of Michigan's affirmative action in hiring and admissions. And such laws, according to the Sixth Circuit, pose an impermissible burden on minorities. Now, the reason that's particularly interesting is that Michigan law is almost identical to the initiative that was passed in Washington State in, I believe, the late 90s that essentially banned affirmative action. And we now have a circuit court ruling that says that type of law won't hold water. So it's kind of an open invitation to somebody to challenge the law in the books in Washington State to see if the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is generally considered more liberal than the Sixth Circuit, might come up with a similar finding. Because the Sixth Circuit ruling does not directly set precedent for this part of the country, but if the ruling were to go to the Supreme Court, or it were challenged out here, then that would set a precedent. And even without that, it's certainly something to stand up and take notice for people who are concerned about those kind of issues.
All right. Moving on to national and a whole bunch of other court rulings this week.
Yeah, let's start with the lower court rulings because those are more positive and more good news, which we try and throw in every now and then. It's just a change of pace here. And
good what? Was.
Yeah, well, news. Good news. It's a phrase we would like to be more familiar with than we actually are in this program, but we try and throw some in every now and then just to, you know, confuse people. First, let's start with something that wasn't a court ruling. It was a regulatory ruling from the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which is the federal body that controls sentencing guidelines for federal crimes. They unanimously voted yesterday to retroactively apply changes in the crack versus powder cocaine sentencing. Now, last year, Congress changed what had been something very frustrating judicial fairness activists for many, many years, which was the 100-to-1 disparity for many years in the guidelines for crack cocaine. 80% 80-90% whose convicts are African Americans versus 70% of powder cocaine offenders are either white or Hispanic. A 100-to-1 difference in the sentencing guidelines, crack being that much more severe. Well, that was finally overturned by Congress last year, and so the U.S. Sentencing Commission has gone back and said we're going to apply that retroactively to the nonviolent inmates who are already in the federal system, and as a result, some 12,000 inmates inmates are now eligible for immediate release based on time already served. Others are eligible to apply for sentence reduction because of that. Now, those changes will actually, I slightly misspoke. It's not immediate. It takes effect on November 1st unless Congress intervenes. And given that a change in that. Now, Congress's change in those guidelines last year was bipartisan, but even if it were challenged, it would have to get through both the democratically controlled Senate and President Obama. So chances are very good that's going to stand. On the other hand, chances are also very good that certain right-wing zealots are going to start demagoguing on this based on race starting in 5, 4, 3, 2. So good news on that front. Good news. Well, no, that wasn't good news. We can skip that. Let's go to the bad news. that being the U.S. Supreme Court, and it had a couple of rulings this week, that once again were pretty dreadful. The first of those, yet another very predictable 5-4 ruling by the conservative majority voiding Arizona's public financing of elections. And now see if you can guess what the reasoning is behind, or if you can deconstruct the reasoning behind this, Trevor.
It discriminates against the rights of the wealthy.
That's actually very, very close. But it's not quite that straightforward. Now, let's say that you're running for office and you have a lot of money. And I'm running for office and don't have a lot of money. And we live in Arizona, which has a public financing law for candidates. And so I receive public financing that you're also eligible for. That, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, is a violation of your free speech rights.
Aha. Uh-huh. See what I mean? if money is speech and I have more money than you, it's discriminatory against me.
It's
to be given money that allows you to speak as much as I can.
Exactly. It discriminates against your right to drown me out.
Exactly.
Yes.
My hard-earned right, by the way.
Your hard-earned right as a proud American.
Not a welfare right, thank you.
No, exactly. A hard-earned right because daddy gave you that money. And no, that actually was the logic behind the conservative majority opinion. And if ever you wanted a lesson in judicial clarity, Justice Kagan in her dissent absolutely destroyed the majority opinion. I highly recommend that people go and read that just for a quick summation of how totally reality challenged the conservative majority in the Supreme Court is now. Yeah. There was also another ruling this past week on the Supreme Court. They ruled that even though parents can protect their children and warnings are allowed and rating systems and bans and so forth on material being sold to minors that has a sexual content, for example, a naked lady is something that you can prevent your child from purchasing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of videos or video games or
magazine.
No, this is the games and videos was specifically specifically the topic here. But parents cannot protect their children against excessive and gratuitous violence. That is something that becomes then a work of art according to the Supreme Court and is therefore protected under the First Amendment. I believe it was Breyer this time that wrote the dissent on that, who posed the question that, so you can have a video game that, that graphically portrays a woman being, bound, gagged, tortured, mutilated, and killed, and that's fine for preteen children, but if she is topless, that is not fine whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is an interesting case in a number of ways because it didn't break down in the traditional 5-4.
No, it did not.
You know, conservative
liberals. It was 7-2.
And commenters have not broken down in a traditional liberal conservative split either, I don't think, in that there are some who see this as a victory for the free speech rights of people under 18 and their kind of consumer rights. And then there are others who are saying, you know, since when did corporations have a right to sell violent material to children? And so some people see it as if we can regulate, you know, pornography, why can't we regulate violence, which is kind of, you know, a form of pornography in their view.
Right.
And other people argue that, well, this is the first step towards chipping away at regulations on pornography too, which probably are not going to go very far in this climate, in this political climate. But it's been interesting to see the splits and the breakdowns in terms of how people have responded to the case.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's also a very good barometer of, you know, societal attitudes in general, or at least societal attitudes when it comes to government regulation and to also corporate output of product to sex versus violence.
Yeah, and also the ways in which the regulation of the culture of violence might be seen as an impingement on, you know, even gun ownership or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That the two are somehow kind of connected, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also connects to the previous ruling that you mentioned in that these are like first-person shooter games are the single most popular games out there and just rake in, you know, billions and billions of dollars every year.
So. Absolutely. But we're not talking about first-person shooter games. We're talking about games that specifically, I mean, I think a lot of those would still probably be fine. It's the ones that show really, you know, gratuitous graphic violence and gore.
But those tend to be first-person shooter games,
but they're a subset of them, of the much larger category of first-person shooter games. It's not all of them.
And interestingly, they even intersect with some of the war games work that the military does in terms of their training and others in terms of the way in which it spreads that sense of, you too can imagine yourself as a soldier.
Yeah, and I think that also is one of the is one of the subtexts to this, is that the militarization of our culture over the last several decades has also contributed to this sort of glorification of violence, and violence is a free speech right,
or just normalization.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to international, starting with Gaza.
Yeah, the Audacity of Hope flotilla tried to
Love
leave this week. Yeah, I do too. They tried to leave this week from Greece, setting sail to symbolically break the siege of the Gaza Strip. But they had some problems. The first problem that they had was that on separate occasions, two of the ships had their propeller shafts damaged, something that if it had not had been discovered in port might well have led to the sinking of the ships once they were out on the open water. And then for those ships that were still shipworthy, several of them were not allowed by Greek authorities to leave port, and one of them that was allowed to leave port, an American ship, was then stopped by Greek authorities less than a mile offshore and forced to return to port. And Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has basically openly said that he's been cooperating with the Greek Prime Minister in letting this happen. So basically, what has happened to the flotilla, which is comprised of ships from a number of different nations, is that they have been banned from leaving a port, which is a total contravention of international law, but probably a more desirable outcome than the Israeli military killing everybody on board, for example. But still, very, very worrisome, and particularly worrisome because, once again, the United States and the Obama administration very much on the wrong side on this issue and saying, well, you know, Israel has a right to defend itself against unarmed flotilla passengers that want to deliver humanitarian aid.
All right. Moving on, Iraq.
Yeah, June became the deadliest month for American soldiers in Iraq in 3 years since June of 2008. 15 Americans killed, mostly through either rocket or mortar attacks on American bases or IEDs. Now, most of this is happening at the hands of Shiite militias, which tend to be fairly closely aligned with the Iraqi government, although the Iraqi government is now making noises about cracking down on some of these militias. There are also a lot of allegations from the American government that there are links between these militias and Iran. But all this is to say that the civil war in Iraq continues unabated, and that whole idea that the war in Iraq is over does not seem to be especially, accurate. And by the way, U.S. fatalities in Afghanistan have also been spiking in the last couple of months. So it's been a deadly time all the way around for U.S. armed forces overseas.
All right. Syria.
Yeah, yesterday seeing the largest yet demonstrations in Syria, and it's been very interesting to contrast the movement in Syria with not just the movement in Libya, which was enough to trigger Western intervention while the West has been pretty much hands off in Syria, but also the degree to which the democracy movement in Syria has been proceeding, even though it has not had a lot of the resources that earlier movements in Egypt and Tunisia did. They have not had access to the internet because the Syrian government has shut it down. They have not had access to international media coverage because the Syrian government has not been letting foreign media into the country. A lot of it has been organized in a very old school manner by word of mouth, by people going from city to city. And nonetheless, you have these enormous, enormous demonstrations, and you have not seen really a lot of support by Western governments because, frankly, they don't have a lot of leverage over over Syria. Syria has allies in a way that Muammar Gaddafi does not, in terms of Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Iranian government. And Iran also allegedly has been offering advice in terms of how it managed to put down its own Green Revolution in 2009. So this is likely to get uglier before it gets better, because those demonstrations are not going away anytime soon.
All right. And briefly, Greece.
Yeah, the Greek government passed severe austerity measures this week, and I'm sure Maria will want to talk about this when she gets back next week a little bit more detail to stave off the possibility of Greece defaulting on its debt. And you saw literally riots in the streets, massive protests in Greece this month. The fix was really in on this. Banks in France and Germany really leaping in as soon as the austerity measures passed, saying, well, we can offer terms on this. This is no problem. This is exactly what we wanted. And so once again, you have an economic crisis essentially serving as yet another wealth transfer from ordinary working people to the very wealthy, in this case the banks that are going to be servicing that debt.
All right. And we'd also seen major strikes, I think, yesterday in the UK.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that, Trevor?
I can talk briefly about it, but I don't actually.
Well,
know
we don't have a lot of time, so briefly works fine.
Well, the gist of it is that there's been a walkout of as many as 750,000 workers, and with student walkouts going alongside in the UK, protesting their own austerity measures, which is always interesting to see, because the UK and the United States have really been kind of the global vanguard of neoliberalism and pushing budget cuts as a response to economic crises. So it's always good to see some form of resistance developing. And it's noteworthy that these are mainly government employees, and you can't see that kind of action in the United States, because federal government employees are not allowed to go on strike.
And I would add to that that in the next month or so, probably just about 4 weeks out, the United States is going to have to take some kind of an action to raise its debt ceiling limit, and the Republicans in Congress are currently holding that hostage over demands for really extensive, sweeping cuts to the federal budget. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the Obama administration gives into some of that, and if so, what the reaction is going to be, and whether there's any kind of resistance to that here in the United States, because there should be.
All right. Events.
Well, we don't have any. Well, we got 4th of July coming up, but we do have one event coming up today, which is from 1 to 4 o'clock at Wyckoff Auditorium. Cindy Domingo.
At Seattle University.
At Seattle University, yes. Cindy Domingo and Jean Viernes are going to be talking about.
It's actually an event in honor of the.
Oh, it's in honor of them. Okay.
Well, Silmi and Jean were assassinated by the Marcos dictatorship 30 years ago in Seattle, and it's a reflection on that anniversary of what kind of legacy did they lead for Filipino American radicals, but also kind of labor activism in Seattle and transnational exchanges. And there are a number of prominent Filipino leftists who are actually in town from the event from the Philippines.
Yeah.
As well as activists from around the country.
Yeah,
so
you talked about Cindy Domingo being involved in this.
Yeah, she's the sister of Silmi Domingo.
Oh, okay, that's the confusion.
And is prominent in the Seattle area as well.
All right, talking with Job Parrish from Eat the State and Trevor Griffey from the Olympia Newswire. And Job, where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. Check it out.